This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Sometimes life can really crash in on you. We often call these moments rough patches, and we try to move on. But in author Nick Brown's new novel, In Every Way, his main character can't seem to get away from the difficulties in her life. Brown's heroine has a mother who is dying, a cheating boyfriend. She is struggling in school, and she's just found out she's pregnant. Nick Brown's new novel is being released February 10th. He's going to read from it in Chapel Hill's Flyleaf Books. But first, he is with us to talk about In Every Way. Nick Brown, welcome back to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back.
The last time we had you here, you were talking about doubles. That book played to much acclaim. Was this book rattling about in your head then? Where did this book come from, the newest one?
I was already working on this book when Doubles was being published. And in the earliest forms then, but this is the first book I've written in its entirety since being a father. And so the main thing on my mind, as probably with any new parent, was parenthood. And I was trying to find a way to write about parenthood. And I was writing about parenthood from the perspective of a father, and these characters showed up around that father that became much more interesting than the father, including this young woman, Maria, who I ended up writing the novel about.
Yeah, I saw that you had gotten a fair way through the first draft of this from the point of view of the father and then realized you couldn't go much farther, came back and told it from Maria's point of view.
Yeah, well, Maria is just so much more interesting than this guy who's probably like me, and nobody wants to read a book about me, you know? And so just as an exercise, I wrote a short story about Maria and her mother, who were both odd characters and seemed to have a lot of life in them. And it was so much more fun to write that. It was a much better piece than all the other stuff I'd, you know, been working on. And that ended up being the first chapter of the book as it is now.
Tell us more about Maria.
Well, Maria's a young woman. She's 19. She's when we first meet her, she's an art student at Chapel Hill. And she is at an odd point in her life because her mother, like you said, is sick. And so she's in a position where she's the caretaker of her mother. And at the same time, she's learned that her boyfriend, Jack, and she have, she's pregnant. And so she's at a funny spot where is she a child or is she a caretaker? You know, who's the mother here now? And so, you know, for me as a fiction writer, that's a useful place to put a character in a very unstable situation like that.
Maybe we can get a better feel for that if you'd read for us, too, would you?
Yeah, this is a section from the first chapter when Maria tells her mother that she's pregnant. She's just given her mother the news. "Now, just a minute," her mother said. "What exactly do you want?" "Not a baby," Maria said. She chuckled. She started to cry. "Seems you already have one of those," her mother said. "It's just a blob." Maria's mother shrugged. "Is it Jack's?" she said. Maria nodded, dragging the back of her index finger across her now running nose. She then instinctively wiped it under the table, only to discover the harsh topography of a miniature inverted mountain range built from the petrified chewing gum of her own childhood. "He's a good guy," her mother said. "People wait their whole lives for that." "What are you saying?" Maria said. "When you're dying," her mother said, "you start to think about babies. You see the whole world through hippie glasses." The doctor had said her mother could expect another 6 months. Maria did the math. There would be no overlap, even if having a child were anything more than some weird, slumming fantasy. "Are you suddenly pro-life?" Maria said. "Yes," her mother said, "in like every way."
Author Nick Brown reading from his latest novel, In Every Way. He's going to be reading from the book at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill Tuesday, February 10th at 7 o'clock, with us now on The State of Things. I think that really illustrates well the sense of that we keep us off balance through the whole book because everybody has reached this plateau and are now asked to shift their point of view. They're always asked to see it in a whole new way from a place that's felt kind of stable when you took us there, Nick.
Yeah. Well,
and now you're pushing me down there.
It makes my job a lot easier as a storyteller when I make my characters find new ways to interact with life, you know? And I love Maria's mother because she's acting like a teenager most of the time. And I love Maria's boyfriend because he is this crazy mishmash of high culture and low culture, quoting, you know, Alexander Dumas and the Wu-Tang Clan in the same sentence. And Maria's navigating this generational, you know, sort of middle ground. And it gives me a lot of leeway to tell a story around that.
She has the baby, and if we're not giving too much away, and she spends, she tries to figure out a way to get closer to that baby.
She does, and she figures out a way to get closer to that baby. She has this feeling that her mother has sort of willed herself to stay alive, to see the birth of the child, and attaches some superstitious belief to it, and thinks maybe if she can continue to find a way to be around this child who she is adopted by another couple. But if she can find a way to be around this child, maybe it'll keep her mother alive. And of course, she has selfish reasons to be around the child, too.
So she does, and she's actually taking care of her own child.
She does. She, through a series of coincidences and not coincidences, manages to have the family that adopted her own child hire her as the nanny for that child. They don't know she's the birth mother. And so, you know, as if that situation wasn't messy enough, it gets even messier from there. But yeah, she spends time every day with her own child without anyone knowing.
And as a good storyteller, the plot thickens. She becomes involved with the father in the house, not the father, but the adoptive father.
Yeah, you know, even I talk about this with my students sometimes too. Even when you reduce the best novels to just the plot, they all sound like General Hospital, you know? I'm teaching Gatsby right now, and we were talking about the plot of that, you know, with the mistresses and the murder. And anyway, it makes me feel a little bit better about this novel.
I'm glad we did that. Why would anybody have to feel? I mean, a good plot, the fact that there are complications. Look, otherwise, there's no art. I mean, that's what we're exploring, are these complications. I mean, there's a reason that we call it soap opera. Opera is considered a high art, and the stories were melodramatic, and they play on daytime TV, and they're good stuff.
That's right. Well, I tell my students, you know, it's not about the plot. It's about how you write it. And so I'm just laughing about our condensed summary of it. But, you know, for me, I keep trying to put pressure on my characters to be uncomfortable. And that's where I feel energy coming off the page.
Well, let's get back to the transition that you had to make, the change that you made in point of view from telling this from the father's point of view and then switching to Maria. Mm-hmm. You're not Maria, and you are not a woman who is pregnant with her mother. So how much of, and particularly when it comes to these kind of gender shifts, I know that, you know, that's your job. You're a pro. You need to get into it. Did you find it was a kind of stretch for you that you had to do some other kind of research, get yourself in another place to really give authentic voice to these characters?
No, not really. You know, I mean, my job as a fiction writer is to write about being a human, and I don't write men's fiction or women's fiction. I'm just trying to write about what it is to be human. And as a craftsman, which is what writing is in a way, I got to find the best way to tell that story. And so, like I said, for me, it was really just sort of a structural or architectural choice to decide to shift the point of view to her perspective. Now, yeah, I'm not a pregnant 19-year-old woman, so luckily I have a wife and friends who can help me with some of the gender differences. And I did do some research, although not a lot. You know, it's a novel. It's just imagination for the most part.
I wonder if I can get you to read for us again.
Sure. I'll read. This is a section that is something, of course, that I could never do myself. It's a section about giving birth, I've had a child. I've talked to people who've done it.
Talked to people. There's videos now. Nick, you can go on YouTube. Watch the whole thing.
During the third sleepless night, the gap finally closes. At the hospital, the pain is worse than anyone had been able to explain. Maria tells herself to expect a leg to fall off, and the fact that one does not is the only thing that makes each contraction seem tolerable. When the baby finally emerges, Jack places the gasping, viscous child upon Maria's breast. She has heard stories of birth mothers who refuse to hold their newborns for fear they might become attached. But Maria is not so afraid. She tells herself she can do it all, that she can love for a few days, and that then she can let go. After all, hasn't she been touching the child for 9 months already? So Maria now holds her child to her chest, sobbing. She is baffled by all that her body has endured. A pride absolute and different from any other she has ever known has settled upon her. She cries, but they are not tears of sadness. Never before has she cried from joy and exhaustion. So these are happy tears, she thinks, and then realizes that she does not know yet what sex the child is. In this moment, Maria uncodes how parents carry on through defect, deformity, and sickness. It doesn't matter what sex this child is, she thinks, or how it is, or why it is. It only matters that it is.
It's author Nick Brown reading from his book, In Every Way. And, of course, she does have a hard time giving up her daughter, Bonnie, for adoption. Talk about some of those difficulties that she experiences.
Well, she feels an immediate connection with her daughter, an immediate love. And like I said earlier, also feels this odd desire to have the child around her mother, that her mother, you know, is helping to keep her alive. And when she does manage to reunite with her daughter, you know, it's a messy thing. She understands that she is complicating the life of the couple that's adopted the child, the perfect family, she thinks. She's picked this perfect family to adopt her child, and here she is ruining it. And she knows she's doing it, but she can't stop. And eventually she finds a way to remove herself, but it's a tricky process.
You know, we talked about sort of having to plot a story, and sometimes they'll fall into tropes, and you know, they can be easily reduced in a minute or two by a talk show host or somebody else. But the themes that you probe in this, and in Doubles, it seems to me, are extremely deep. The idea that we construct our own identities, that they get, in many ways, there's a script laid out for us. There are things constructed for us if we're born into this society. And then we kind of make our own attachments to a particular self. And when they bang up against who we might be at a deeper level, we suffer enormous pain because we can't let go of the identities we've been handed and the ones we've constructed. And it seems to me that if you're looking for that kind of depth, it is in this book.
I appreciate that. Both of those novels, I agree, were explorations of shifting identity. And that's just a very useful place to put characters, you know, as a fiction writer. We're spending time in Maria's brain, and I like being inside of a brain that's handling, you know, complicated things, complicated questions like that. So it gives me a lot of ammunition.
Can I get you to read one more for us?
Sure. This is later in the novel when Maria is coming to realize the complicating effect she's having on the life of the adoptive couple. Evening, early December. The day is dull and biting, filled with a damp chill that cuts through Maria's wool coat. The magnolia in Karen's yard glitters with cold white Christmas lights, hung 2 days prior by Christofferson and his lawn care partner. The cloud cover clears late in the day, and the last of the sun's light, fading in red, suddenly fills the sky. It's postcard material. So beautiful, Maria feels it's too easy to enjoy, that she should resist it. But she cannot. Her heart, it seems, has expanded with pseudo-motherhood. In her art history class once, Maria's professor said that Diane Arbus's photographs of mentally disabled children in Halloween costumes wrought beauty from the grotesque. He said standard beauty in today's world had been rendered powerless. At the time, it seemed profound. Now Maria wonders if the professor ever had children. Her phone rings. "I'm so sorry," Nina says. Bonnie is crying in the background. "I know you're busy." "I'm not busy," Maria says. She tosses the magazine into a wicker basket beside the couch. "I just can't get her to sleep," Nina says. "Okay," Maria says, her heart racing on the thrill of Nina's dependence. "You want me to come over?" "Could you?" Already Nina has found motherhood impossible without Maria. It is not that she is a bad mother at all, it is only that she is perhaps too willing to allow Maria to be the one to handle difficulties such as these. And Maria is only too eager to help. Without her, Nina would rise to the challenge, but Maria enjoys the cultivation of dependence. Together, the three of them, Nina, Maria, and Philip, seem to be building a house dependent on one trick Joyce. But Maria has decided not to think about structural integrity. She has chosen to ignore the future. Her prognostications have already turned out to be so wrong so often that she is now ceasing to make them. She is weaving a patchwork only of the smallest pieces of time here. Days, hours, scenes.
Novelist Nick Brown reading from his latest, In Every Way, is going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on Tuesday at 7 o'clock. That was great. The reference to Diane Arbus, of course, is again another reference to Whose Identity Is It? She was famous for photographing extraordinary people called freaks in her time and contextualizing them in a way that made us see them in a whole new way, whatever role we gave them. That's cool. I want to talk about Doubles because it's going to be a film and you are writing the screenplay or have written it.
Well, I've written the screenplay. I don't know a lot about Hollywood, but I know it's hard to make a movie. But the director, David Burris, who I know was a guest here not too long back, and the producer of Survivor, the TV show, optioned the novel. And with another author, Emily Testa, I wrote the screenplay. And David and his producer are hard at work trying to make it come to life. So, you know, fingers crossed.
We'll have you back for that, Nick.
Great, thanks.
Nick Brown, author of In Every Way, reading from that book on Tuesday, February 10th, Flyleaf Books, 7 o'clock. If you missed it, check out our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagni, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski sitting in today. Jess Clark is our intern. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.